Good morning. This is the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Bob Martin. We're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, April 17th, 2019. We begin with the news section. Cracks in the pavement. A half century ago, Durham cut off Haiti from downtown. Now, Haiti leaders want to reconnect their neighborhood to the city's core. Angela Lee sits at her desk in the Haiti Heritage Center on Old Fayetteville Street. Through the window behind her, there's a backdrop of cranes building apartments. To Lee, the center's executive director, such projects don't signal progress. They forewarn loss. After all, when she goes to work every day, she walks into the last remaining structure from historic Haiti. When Haiti was a thriving community, along with Black Wall Street, we were all one, Lee said. There were houses and shops and commerce all the way to Perry Street. In 1970, as a part of the city's urban renewal program, developers constructed the Durham Freeway directly through the northeast part of the neighborhood. Urban renewal displaced over 4,000 families and 500 businesses, and the freeway cut off Haiti from what's now considered downtown Durham. City officials reneged on promises to replace the demolished buildings. The neighborhood has never recovered. Now Lee and the Haiti Heritage Center are trying to reconnect the neighborhood to downtown and bring the voices of Haiti residents into discussions about Durham's future, by improving pedestrian access between the two. Using a $12,500 nonprofit grant, Lee plans to create a route from Haiti to Black Wall Street Gardens in the heart of the downtown, and in the process do away with the false demarcation of NC 147 as the edge of the city's urban center. It will get people re-energized about their community to feel like they are not being rejected or disregarded by the city, Lee said. That has been a prevailing attitude because, well, we have been. Haiti, wedged between Fayetteville Street and the Durham Freeway, began as a hub for freed slaves to settle after emancipation. By the early 1900s, it had grown so prosperous that W.E.B. Du Bois considered it a model for how black communities could thrive in the Jim Crow South. Today, housed in what was once St. Joseph's AME Church, the Heritage Center stands tall, its steeple overlooking the Walgreens and the KFC across the busy five-lane road, lined with cracked sidewalk void of pedestrians. It presides over a neighborhood of dilapidated buildings that house predominantly black residents, with an eviction notice rate nearly seven times Durham's average. Lee is tired of watching development intrude on Haiti without incorporating the community itself. While the Heritage Center focuses on Haiti's cultural significance, Lee has also advocated for longtime residents who have watched their community deteriorate as other parts of Durham thrive and who continue to be squeezed out as more condos go up and land values skyrocket. Lee points to Heritage Square, a shopping center down the street from Heritage Center, which recently sold to a Texas developer for $12 million. Do you think that shopping center is going to remain a shopping center with small businesses, she asked? What ramifications does a purchase like that have? How will that impact Haiti? Development in Haiti is inevitable. Durham is expected to add 160,000 new residents over the next quarter century, and development has already begun to march south of the freeway. But while land values are rising rapidly, 133% since 2016, according to a recent News and Observer analysis of the census tract that includes Haiti, which also includes some land north of North Carolina 147, the median income for Haiti's census tract is just over $18,000. Some residents whose families have been there for generations can no longer afford housing. According to DataWorks NC, 56% of the area's residents are cost burdened, which means that they pay more in rent than what is considered affordable based on their level of income. Haiti is one of 12 communities nationwide that were awarded a grant in 2019 through the nonprofit Safe Routes to School National Partnership. The award provides a springboard for the Heritage Center to launch an initiative called Reconnecting Downtown, Restoring Haiti's Connection to the Heart of Durham. With the grant, the Haiti Heritage Center will partner with Extraterrestrial Projects, a nonprofit that promotes sustainable and equitable city infrastructure, as well as local developers, artists, and Haiti residents to plan a safe walking route along Fayetteville Street to the Black Wall Street Gardens on Perry Street, which commemorates the African-American business community that flourished in Durham in the early 20th century. Right now, it's unsafe to walk almost anywhere in Haiti. Sidewalks are cracked and uneven. Signage is lacking, and there are not nearly enough street lights, stoplights, or crosswalks. People are going to be more reluctant to get out and move about freely, daytime or nighttime, when it is hazardous, Lee said. A 2017 study in the Journal of Transportation Geography found that high traffic volumes are a known barrier to walking, bicycling, and access to transit, as well as a contributor to community severance and diminished social capital. These high-volume roadways, the study found, were likely to be located near low-income neighborhoods and the communities of color, as is the cases here. I am most concerned with Fayetteville Street, says Tara Mee Smith, executive director of Extraterrestrial Projects, because if you've ever tried to walk it, you're like, am I trying to die? Haiti residents seeking to cross the freeway and access downtown without a car have but two options: head west for a few blocks to Roxborough Street or take Fayetteville. Residents have been advocating for improvements for decades. In 2005, a resident group put together the historic Fayetteville Street Corridor Master Plan, a detailed study of infrastructure needs that sought to strengthen public safety initiatives, improve the corridor's appearance and function, foster economic and small business development, increase home ownership, and make transportation enhancements. While the city has adopted some of the plan's ideas, residents contend their neighborhood hasn't gotten the same attention as others. It is not that the city council doesn't have the appetite for streetscape funding and streetscapes, for the other three gateways into downtown have all been funded, some more than once, says Denise Hester, a member of the original 2005 Fayetteville Street Planning Group. She said that at a city council meeting last month. The other gateways are Old Five Points, 9th Street, and Angier Drive. Not sharing our city's booming prosperity by investing in infrastructure for Fayetteville Street, I fear, will only increase the growing economic divide that threatens our city's future, and I think that divide is apparent to everyone in this room as it manifests itself in all kinds of unfortunate ways. With the grant, Haiti residents can focus on improving their community and play an active role in assessing their community's needs. The grant partners say that. Smith and her team plan to engage residents in conceptualizing the most effective way to promote safety and accessibility. The goal is to complete the community assessment by September. Lee and Smith will eventually present their plan to the city's departments of transportation and parks and recreation, with the hope that Haiti residents' voices will be better incorporated into the city's capital improvement plan for the area. When we are thinking about new policy, it is really important to not repeat the mistakes of the past and work to repair harm so that the decedents of the founders of our city can stay in place. Willie Bigelow, a longtime resident of Haiti, remembers when the city tore down iconic institutions like the Biltmore Hotel and the Regal Theater, places the community built for itself in response to the exclusion from white institutions like the Carolina Theater. "It's like losing a friend from your childhood," Bigelow said. Now it appears that Durham is moving into the Haiti area instead of them adopting or connecting with Haiti. The city has taken steps to preserve affordable housing in the area. Nearby, a third phase of mixed-income housing is planned for the city-backed Southside redevelopment on Lakewood Avenue. Over the next decade, the Durham Housing Authority plans to redevelop three of its properties in the area into mixed-income and, in some cases, mixed-use neighborhoods, including Fayette Place, a vacant property that sits near where Grant Street was bisected by the freeway. And earlier this year, Mayor Steve Shewell proposed a $95 million bond to fund all of this and more. The city needs a new sense of urgency around implementing these equitable engagement strategies, because once things are built, we can't go back. We can't engage the community retroactively, Beasley said. Our next news article, Permanent Solutions. Why are people staying three times longer than they used to at Urban Ministries of Durham's homeless shelter? The average length of stay at Urban Ministries of Durham's downtown homeless shelter has more than tripled over the last 15 months. In just over a year, UMD families went from staying an average of 33 days to 116. Singles have increased their length of stay from 24 to 77 days. Joe Daly, UMD's Director of Development, says the growing length of stay has to do with the shelter's emphasis on the Housing First model, which focuses on finding clients stable housing and preventing further homelessness. With the city's lack of affordable housing and the Durham Housing Authority's long wait list for Section B vouchers, it is becoming increasingly difficult to find a place for clients to live after they leave the shelter. The Housing First model has also been adopted by the Continuum of Care in Durham. That's a collection of public and private agencies and service providers helping to address homelessness as we see it in Durham. It's really considered best practice at this point in terms of helping folks exit to permanent housing as quickly as possible. Once a person experiences homelessness and goes from this continuum of care, his or her total amount of time in the system is tracked cumulatively. So if a UMD client leaves the shelter but returns a few years later, each visit counts toward the total length of stay. On any given night in Durham, about 590 people experience homelessness, whether they are staying in a shelter, a car, or on the street. UMD offers 149 beds to men, women, and children, and it also keeps a reserve of 30 beds for cold winter nights. But the longer people stay in a shelter, the fewer beds it has for new clients. As a result, the number of people UMD served declined last year to 792, compared with 826 in 2017. UMD Executive Director Sheldon Mitchell explained during an April 1st presentation to the Durham County Board of Commissioners that UMD clients often face multiple barriers to find housing, little or no income, medical and mental health challenges, and criminal records that may bar them from housing and voucher eligibility. As far as length of stay goes, we are definitely interested in getting those numbers to go in the opposite direction, if possible. But there are just a lot of factors that are contributing to it, Daly said. Within the system, there are barriers to folks getting housing, having the income to pay for housing, the ability of voucher landlords willing to take folks on, and even getting together the documents that they are needed to obtain that housing. That can literally take months. While long lengths of stay present challenges for other Durham shelters, including Families Moving Forward and the Durham Rescue Mission, neither has seen the sharp increase that occurred at UMD over the past year. Families Moving Forward, which serves families with children, tracks an average length of stay between 130 and 142 days, while the Durham Rescue Mission, with its clients for a much shorter period, about 32 days. Daly thinks UMD's spike might have something to do with the increasing amount of chronic homelessness that has seen among clients over the past year. The most recent surveys show that 31% of UMD's residents are chronically homeless, meaning that they have been homeless for more than a year or repeatedly over several years. These folks are coming to us with more personal barriers and more of a difficult history to overcome in order to get them housed, Daly said. It's tougher. Given the state of the housing crisis in Durham, it may be difficult to prevent that sort of bottlenecking that UMD and other service providers are seeing. However, Daly thinks that a few of the city's recent interventions are on the right track, including city-supported programs to help people expunge charges from their criminal records and to provide landlords with incentives to accept Section 8 vouchers. Then we get back to the question of, well, we need more affordable housing, Daly said. The city is ramping up its efforts, but it won't be quick or cheap. In his recent State of the City address, Mayor Steve Shule proposed a $95 million affordable housing bond, which would build more than 1,800 affordable rental units, and if passed, become the largest affordable housing bond in state history. Durham is also trying to prevent homelessness through eviction diversion, an effort to keep people out of shelters in the first place. Bringing the average length of stay down comes back to the keeping people out of the cycle of chronic homelessness. For UMD staff, this is the goal. Our hope is that once folks move on into that next step of their lives, they're not ever having to return to stay with us within the walls of the shelter, Daly said. The next news article, Fresh Blood. Running to be Raleigh's youngest mayor, 27-year-old Zanib Balak said she'd offer innovative solutions to old problems. Growing up in the North Raleigh, Zanib Balak began volunteering at her local mosque in fifth grade, where they're branching out to nonprofits and activism at North Carolina State. She has a master's degree in public administration from UNC Chapel Hill, but fashions herself more as a boots-on-the-ground organizer. She rides the bus from her southeast Raleigh home to her job downtown at Even Responsible Finance, and she portrays herself as focused more on engaging with the community than climbing the political ladder. She did, however, run for city council in 2017, placing fifth in the free-for-all at-large race. This year, Balak is mounting a long-shot bid for mayor, challenging the better-known and better-financed former city council member Marianne Baldwin, former Wake County Commissioner Caroline Sullivan, and Raleigh lawyer Charles Francis. The biggest difference between her and them, Balak is 27 years old, 6 years younger than Raleigh's youngest mayor, Thomas Bradshaw Jr., who was elected to one term in 1971. Balak would also be the only Muslim and woman of color to serve as Raleigh's mayor. The Indy spoke with Balak about her campaign last week. The interview has been edited for length and clarity, but you can listen to the entire conversation on IndyCast, the Indy's podcast, which is available through Apple Podcast, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. Question from the Indy. Why do you want to be mayor? She answered, I want to be Raleigh's next mayor because I think our city can provide a platform for our future. We have a number of communities that are not represented right now in our city government. The lack of representation not only is preventing us from addressing these communities' needs, but it also keeps us from having innovative ideas to really bring about innovative solutions to old problems. And then Indy said, what got you into local politics? She said, I never thought I'd be a politician. I've always been a community organizer. I went to protest one day and somebody had suggested it, and I'd never thought about it. And I realize that the people who know the people on the ground are the ones who are able to make policies that represent them. It comes with the experience of talking to different community groups, different people of different races, religions, ethnicities, but also of different income levels, and understanding and being empathetic towards those issues and making policies that represent them. The Indian then asked, "What policies would you make a priority?" She answered, "My platform focuses on mobility, security, and happiness. Raleigh has one of the worst upward mobility rates in the country, and what I truly believe is in the right to have that upward mobility. And that means you have the right to find a good job nearby. You have the right to have infrastructure that gets you to where you need to be. The right to thrive in your career choices. And then security. We see that right now. Not all communities feel safe. And so under security, we are really talking about the right to find basic needs in your neighborhood. Southeast Raleigh is considered a food desert." The Indy then asked, "What do you think of the affordable housing crisis in Raleigh?" She replied, "It seems like we're building housing, but we're not building any communities. Like, we're evaluating our impact just based on the number of units that we create versus whether we actually impacted a family's life. When we talk about affordable housing, I think one thing is the terminology. We should really be talking about workforce housing and what that looks like in a holistic approach versus just talking about income. We're not creating enough housing for what we need. And with more people moving in, everyone who's moving in is not wealthy. People are going to need places to live. You're going to need a workforce. We're seeing a shortage of workers downtown because they can't afford to live near downtown, and people might not have transportation to get there because we don't have the infrastructure." The Indy went on, "What about the city council's new voluntary inclusionary zoning initiative to encourage developers to build affordable housing?" She answered, "It's interesting because we've always pointed to the fact that mandatory inclusionary zoning is not allowed by the legislature. I feel like this is one of the issues that we're not looking at any other approaches. We're just looking at what we know and what's there. We're not willing to take risks. But I personally just feel it's not strong enough. It's not strong enough. We're not doing enough." The Indy went on, "What would a different approach look like?" She said, "First off, providing some type of incentives. But I always support creating mixed-use units and finding innovative ways to solve this problem. The first step is reaching out to people and figuring out what's out there. Minneapolis just ended single-family zoning. That's helping a lot right now. They're the only council in the entire country to do that. Single-family housing zoning was put into place during segregation. So we as a city need to look at these policies that were put into place at a time that definitely wasn't representative of everyone. And for us to continue using them is very clearly saying we don't represent everyone." And finally, the Indy said, "Most other candidates have held public office. What makes you qualified?" She replied, "I think that's exactly what makes me qualified. Because right now, we have people in office who have had the political experience, and I have experience in people. I have experience in working with almost every type of community right now in Raleigh, and that brings unique experiences." Our next news article, Raising Cane. A developer wants to build Raleigh's tallest skyscraper. Will the city council let him? Developer John Cain's proposed 40-story skyscraper seems to check every box for Raleigh's downtown growth and density plans. The three-acre lot at the intersection of Peace and Harrington Streets sits along a planned bus rapid transit line with no single-family housing nearby. The tower would be anchored by first-floor retail space and include a parking deck, offices, and more than 400 residential units. It would loom over Capitol Boulevard as the city's tallest structure. The PNC building is 32 stories and will serve as a gateway to downtown. But that doesn't mean the city council will go for it, says Councilmember Kay Crowder, even if Kane agrees to include affordable units in the project. They came and talked to me about it months ago, and I laughed, Crowder said. You always laugh when people ask for that much. The proposal comes as the council considers making affordable housing a bargaining chip for developers in rezoning applications and could be the initiative's first big test. State law prevents Raleigh from mandating inclusionary zoning, that is, forcing developers to include affordable units as a condition of building. But Raleigh is considering would be voluntary, at least technically. If you want to rezone, you can boost your chances by volunteering to build affordable units. The city's planning commission is reviewing Kane's request to increase the height limit from 12 to 40 stories. But the building hasn't been yet designed, says Bonner Gaylord, a former council member and Kane's managing director of operations. While Kane would like to include affordable units, Gaylord said, it's difficult to make that promise as part of a rezoning application. Kane needs the city to approve his application before he can start the multi-million-dollar design process. That, in turn, has to happen before Kane can approach financial backers. Committing to an affordable component now, Gaylord said, could make it impossible to secure those financiers. It's hard to commit to affordable housing before you get financing, Gaylord said. It could be a poison pill for a project that we don't know we're taking, but down the road, it ends up killing the whole project. Including affordable units could also drive up prices on the remaining units, providing cheaper housing by making housing more expensive, Gaylord said. A 40-story project could have significant ramifications for utilities and traffic downtown, says Planning Commissioner and former Indy columnist Bob Geary. Adding an affordable component could be a way to mitigate those impacts, he said. I do think this is an appropriate case where we can have affordable housing units offered as a condition of approval that would help with a lot in our minds. If you're going to allow that many people to live in one location, they should be at varying income levels. We shouldn't follow the market here exclusively. Even so, he's not sold yet on 40 stories, and neither is Crowder. While Crowder insists the council won't use voluntary affordability as a hammer to force the developer's hand, courts would likely view that as illegal, she said. The council could take affordable units into consideration along with things like traffic enhancements and parking. 40 stories is not a given, Crowder said. There would have to be a lot of community benefit for me to be open to 40 stories where it is currently entitled to 12. If the voluntary condition is adopted, it will be a big test, says Councilmember David Cox. As far as it being a bargaining chip, I don't know. We're in new territory with this voluntary condition. Kane isn't the only developer eyeing high-density development in that part of downtown. Developer Bobby Lewis hopes to add a 20-story hotel across the street from the new Publix on Peace Street. And another developer, whom Crowder declined to name, might ask for a 40-story rezoning just across Capitol Boulevard from Kane's project. The North Central Citizens Advisory Council backed Kane's request in a 10-5 vote. Really, it comes down to taking areas that are already designated for transportation projects, like bus rapid transit, and putting people in places where they can benefit from those projects, says Dylan Butters, a North Central CAC member who supports the project. This is not old Raleigh anymore. It's growing up, and we can't stop it from growing up, but we can encourage it to grow the right way. The Planning Commission will review Kane's zoning request on April 23rd. A decision could come by June, according to Chairman Rodney Schwenk. Our next article, Fire and Fury. Here's what we know about the explosion that shook Durham last Wednesday, and what we don't. On Saturday morning, Durham residents and officials gathered downtown for what was supposed to be a purely joyous occasion, a birthday party to mark the 50th anniversary of the Bull Cities Incorporation. And while families enjoyed giveaways, performances, and a race to see which inflatable bull would make it down to the American Tobacco Company River the fastest, the celebration began on a somber note. "I want to start out with a few serious words about the events of the past week," said Mayor C. Shule. "We all know Durham has had a tough week." 3 days earlier, on Wednesday, April the 10th, Durham's actual sesquicentennial, and just a half mile away, an explosion triggered by a gas leak rocked Brighton Square, leaving a local business owner dead, 25 injured, 15 buildings damaged, and many questions unanswered. Shule described arriving at the scene just moments after a building at 115 North Duke Street, home to the Caffeinate Coffee Shop and construction technology company Prescient, had exploded, sending out a boom heard miles away. "When we got there, our firefighters were already there standing as far as I am from you," he said, gesturing to the crowd 10 feet away. "In this incredibly, incredibly big fire, this huge blaze was blazing, and they were standing there bravely putting their hoses on it. Some of them have recovered just then from the huge blast that had knocked them down. There were people on the ground who had been hurt by shrapnel and glass." City officials said Wednesday that the gas leak occurred when an unnamed contractor struck a gas line while boring into the sidewalk outside the building and identified the person killed as Kong Lee, Caffeinate's 61-year-old owner. As the Indy went to press Tuesday, the city was still investigating what caused the gas to ignite and level 115 North Duke Street. No one has yet taken responsibility for striking the gas line. A company called Fiber Technologies Networks, LLC, was the only company permitted to dig in the area at the time of that blast, according to city records. The permit authorized Fiber Technologies to work underneath many of the downtown's main arteries between June 27, 2018, and June 25, 2019. The reason for the work, according to the permit, was to connect cell tower to arterial antenna poles. Prior to digging, companies are supposed to call 811, which then notifies utilities to mark their own lines above ground. According to the 811 app, a company called PS Splicing LLC reported damage to the gas line at 9:28 a.m., about 10 minutes before a 911 call was made reporting the leak. Under North Carolina law, a company that damaged a gas line is required to report it. PC Splicing didn't respond to messages from the Indy by press time. Louise Panzer, 811's executive director, confirmed that PS Splicing also notified the agency it would be working in the area of the explosion on April 10th. The News and Observer reported Monday that the CEO of PS Splicing, Don Smith, lost an eye and suffered burns to nearly half his body in the blast, but was not performing the work himself. Last week, Crown Castle, which owns Fiber Technologies, said the company hired a contractor who was installing fiber in the area prior to the incident. On Monday, a spokesperson for the company would not confirm that PCS Splicing was that contractor. Deputy City Manager Bo Ferguson says the permit documents were prepared by a Charlotte-based engineering firm. Utilis, which may have hired subcontractors to do the work, Utilis declined to comment further to the Indy, and a contact person listed on the permit could not be reached. Because we don't have any direct relationships with the subcontractors, it's not uncommon that we don't know who is doing the work, Ferguson said. That doesn't change the fact that the people who fill out the permits are accountable to the city for complying with the permit, for complying with the license agreement, and for complying with all city, state, and federal applicable laws. Whoever hit the line smelled the gas and called 911, but seemed to underestimate the situation, at least initially. We have hit a gas service on North Duke between Main Street and Morgan Street, an unidentified called at 911 at 9:37 a.m. We probably need a little police presence until the gas company can get out here to shut the leak off. It's just a gas service, but just to be on the safe side until the gas company gets here. The explosion occurred at about 10:07 a.m., according to fire officials, blowing out windows on surrounding blocks. It would be another hour before the gas could be shut off, because an employee who initially tried to shut it off was injured by the blast. According to PSNC, the natural gas company, the company has said it properly marked the gas line, but the scene was still inaccessible Monday morning, so that claim is impossible to verify. Before the explosion, firefighters evacuated about a dozen people from Caffeine 8, no question, saving their lives. They spoke to everyone in the shop, Fire Chief Robert Zolas said at a press conference last week, including Lee, the owner. Lee didn't immediately heed an evacuation order, Zolas said, and a firefighter went to get a police officer to make him leave the store that he had to run into his children, who had run with his children since 2017. That's when the building exploded and collapsed, Zolas said. The last we heard from our dad, Lee's children wrote on Instagram, he called to tell us that there was a gas leak outside and to let our staff and customers know that we would be closed for the day. He was going to close up and make a sign to put on our door in case anybody came by later. 9 firefighters were injured, including one who suffered serious injuries and had to undergo surgery, as well as people in nearby offices and on a private bus that was on Duke Street. Their names and conditions have not been released. 2 restaurants, St. James Seafood and Torero's, were condemned, and several West Village apartments were uninhabitable. We're going to need support, Lee's family and the family of all the people that were injured going forward, she will said Saturday, and I know that we will as a city do that. While it's unclear exactly what went wrong Wednesday, it is clear that both city residents have heeded Shule's call. By Monday afternoon, nearly $200,000 had been raised online for people affected by the blast. Restaurant workers now out of a job, family whose loved ones suffered injuries, and $140,000 for the Lee family. We turn now to the indie food section. High heaven! You never get over your first stoned hot and sour soup. I have long made it a mission of my life to seek the world's rarefied culinary experiences. Very few, though, have been as stupefyingly profound as the first time I ate hot and sour soup while stoned. Many years ago, on a balmy spring night, I met up with some dear friends who happened to bear with them a sizable bag of helpless selection of paraphernalia. This event coincided with the end of a period where I had been abstaining from weed, so when presented with the business end of a 2-foot graphics, I decided to bite back into that apple with gusto. It was likely some ditch-grown Texas dirt weed, but to me, it was nothing but the kindest of buds. I got extremely high. Several blocks of classic rock radio later, our group coalesced at our old, reliable, and brightly lit Chinese restaurant nestled in a dingy shopping center. I was high to the point that my friends had to sort of steer me inside and make sure I didn't cause problems. But once we sat down, I put forth a game attempt at not acting like an insane person. The moment I tasted that soup, however, the facade was instantly shattered by the fact that I just started laughing and sort of crying uncontrollably at how good it tasted. Every experienced pot smoker has had mundane foodstuffs, Doritos, Peach Snapple, Starburst, etc., elevated to giddy heights by a few preprandial puffs. But friends, this was not the munchies. This was transcendental. I felt my mind dissolve, my sense of self carried away by pungent, umami fritch broth. The soup was like the blob, a slick and grossly alien consciousness bent on absorbing my thinking brain, and I utterly succumbed. I may have experienced total ego death and became one with the cosmic soup force. Or I may have just been super baked. Either way, it was a deeply pleasurable and humiliating experience. This formative meal occurred in my mildly wayward youth when I was very good at smoking pot, fully capable of getting high and performing complex tasks like learning harmonica and graduating from college. I'm now a 38-year-old dad and a very, very bad at smoking pot. The best I can hope for with weed these days is successfully talking myself down from an anxiety attack during a Primal Scream show. There was no bass in the mix, and that was not okay. To this day, I can conjure that warm, gauzy sensation with even the most cursory bowl of hot and sour soup. I smell the first vinegary punch and instantly feel just a little bit altered. Pillow-soft morsels of tofu and mushroom float by in their viscous, otherworldly broth, and I feel young and dumb and disreputable and, most important, sated. Now from the indie stage section, Symphony of Rubbish. In the belly of the scrap exchange, Paideia sweeps away the boundaries between movement and sound, music and noise, and participant and witness. Caitlin Sweat is taking stock of the so-called junk in the belly of the scrap exchange, where the arms of multicolored shirts dangle from a cardboard box like phantom limbs and yards of rolled fabric, and they resemble exposed pipes. It's an imaginative landscape of mess where creativity and lived history commingle. The mounds of scrap, the way that everything falls into place, is already, it feels like, art to me, Sweat said. For three nights this weekend, the movement and sound trio Paideia, whose core members are Sweat, who lives in Durham, Blakeney Bullock, who lives in Winston-Salem, and Widow, who lives in New York City, will work with several interdisciplinary collaborators to explore the space and its varied contents with one central question in mind. Who gets to belong? I think of all the bits and baubles that scrapes of things, Quit said. They all had a life and are coming to a meeting place. It's like what we're doing. Everyone has their interest in this inquiry, and we're coming together in a singular space to converse. This new piece represents both a challenge to and amplification of Paideia's prior work, which Bullock describes as an improvisational interreaction between soundscape, sound collage, noise, and the body. The trio's name is a reference to a Socratic education model in which discussion is often conducted in a circle and emphasizes open-ended questioning and critical listening. This is how Paideia considers its relationship to its audience, not as divided, but as concentric parts of the same circle. Each tier has a different sort of participation, a tier for movement, sound, and witnesses, Bullock said. Sweat, Bullock, and Window have worked together in different ways and configurations over the years, but solidified their presence as Paideia with two performances in Durham. Within the sequence, at Monkey Bottom Collaborative in 2016, and Split Bill with Kara Hagen at Treehouse Studios last year. They're also the only group in the Durham Independent Dance Artist season that fits into the International Noise Conference, the big annual noise music festival in Miami, where they performed this year. In Split Bill, amplifiers, electronics, and contact microphones were spread across the room, and each part of the trio shifted fluidly between adding experimental sound and exploratory movement, smearing the edges of hierarchies and roles. they ended with an image that embodied this concept. Back to back, playing chimes, they stood or crouched at three different heights, but all revolved in the same circle. Widow says Split Bill was a turning point in Padilla's collaboration, further collapsing the boundaries between movers and musicians. In On Conversation about the new work, the word collapse keeps coming up regarding both the boundaries between roles and the way the trio uses improvised movement and sound emotionally and kinesthetically as a way of being together in the fullness of compassion and confrontation. We err on the side of intensity, on the side of deeply felt emotion, opinion, and action, Bullock says. Perhaps this intimate orbit is what enables the trio to open and expand. Each of them brings their own interpretation to that question, who gets to belong? For artists and audiences alike, it's an inquiry meant to resonate at the personal-political intersection. Each member of the trio also invited two artists to prepare a response that will manifest in two ways, physically, on each night of the performance, and as a written reflection incorporated in a post-performance zine. Some artists might produce monologues, while others might project images. It's up to them. But it all arises from the structure Padilla is creating for the piece, a sort of algorithm that sets the timing and spatial cues while remaining concealed. It's a way to introduce microcosmic mechanisms to power and control and make dynamics of play belonging play out, membership, exclusion, attachment, and ownership. In keeping with Padilla's interest in equilateral action, Sweat says it's important for the trio over the course of the piece to destabilize its self-created structure, too. In replicating and mutating these dynamics, a new, more collaborative work gleams into view. What if we invited artists who make dynamic decisions and got to be with them in the space while they negotiate accountability among other people, Widow says. We thought that could be really exciting, like, what if we could build that ideal world? The Scrap Exchange, with all its materiality, is another collaborator, another world builder with political meaning. The assortment of objects is like a physical representation of where capitalism has gotten us, Bullock said. Placing a performance in this aftermath, in a space where consumer detritus meets creative potential, it's a way of making labor and capital personal. Aesthetically, this interplay of bodies and objects might seem cacophonous. In a given moment, it might alienate or entice. There's room to move closer to the performers or to drift away down the aisles. Either way, a relationship takes shape between people and material forms. This symphony of rubbish, as Widow calls it, is about to whom and what we're beholden and how we decide. Belonging is, after all, intimately connected to power. Who holds it? Who wields it? Who upends it? Also from the indie stage section, Sacred Cow. A play that broke ground in 1984 now feels like the well-meaning work of an outsider. In a week when our chief executive compared the Odyssey immigrants' endure to a vacation like, let's go to Disneyland, Burning Coal Theater Company's production of The Great Celestial Cow administers a needed corrective to that jaded, fictional political narrative. In the 1980s, British playwright Sue Townsend witnessed the xenophobia and racism that Indian expatriates encountered in the United Kingdom. She also saw the wrenching cultural disorientation and sometimes vicious intergenerational schisms that erupted when younger, more progressive women bridled the sexism and caste-based prejudice of their elders. Life for Indian women in England was no vacation, and Townsend's drama was an attempt, groundbreaking in its 1984 premiere at London's Royal Court Theatre, to place their concerns on a national stage. Unfortunately, 35 years later, The Great Celestial Cow reads as the undeveloped episodic work of an outsider. To be fair, Townsend interrogates not only gender bias, but also the hierarchies between family members that she saw in Leicester. For 5 years, the exhausted Sita, a vivid Seema Kuriaja, and her children had been separated from their husband and father, who left India for England before them, with his mother and sister. Cow shows how temporary separations can seed permanent estrangements. But Townsend leaves out too many dots in Sitka's downward spiral. In one scene, she's taking part in a good-natured roast of her son, Prem, as a potential young husband-to-be. In the next, she's having a psychotic breakdown in front of a mirror. Under Sonia Desai's uncertain direction, there's little subtlety in the disdain mother-in-law Daidama and Auntie Masi have for Sita or their preference for Prem over Sitka's daughter Bibi. In his debut, Depcat Dar doesn't believably convey a love or menace of Raj, the family patriarch. Joey DeSena and Kelly Budinski have the thankless task of playing brief, flat supporting roles. A racist greengrocer, a clueless, British hippie. At least Pimpilla Villette is amusing as the tasteless suitor whose arranged marriage attempt is deftly derailed by Bibi. Nina Rai's colorful costumes include an imaginative take on the goddess Kali and Daniel James' full-size rendering of Sitka's beloved cow, Princess, and gives emotional presence to a symbol of lost holiness and community. But on opening night, Desai hadn't solved the problems that a cascade of short scenes, with lengthy changes in between, posed to the show's pacing. The region's Asian population, along with its Latinx and African-American communities, rarely see their stories on stage. But a problematic script and an uneven cast makes The Great Celestial Cow a largely squandered opportunity at a time when we need to hear such communities tell their own stories. Now from the indie screen section, Triangle Confidential. The difference between Southern Gothic and Southern Noir embodied in two local shorts. There's a long, rich tradition of Southern Gothic films, but Southern Noir is something different and a rarer species. Southern Gothic is essentially tragic, treating darkness as a normalized part of society, reference Deliverance, whereas noir is essentially psychological, treating darkness as something that comes from the outside of society. It exists in the tension between what we consider civilized and transgressive. Beyond Blood Simple, One False Move, Winter's Bone, and Cold in July, few films use the South as a backdrop for stories about crimes that push its people outside of the comforts of society. But you can add a couple more to the list thanks to the new Southern Noir Film Hour, which debuts on April 25th at Morocco. It's a double feature of shorts by local filmmakers that take advantage of their Southern setting, the Triangle in particular, as a backdrop for visually hushed stories about very bad things. With the screenings preceded by a performance from the band Swedish Wood Patrol and followed by a question and answer with the cast and crew. Both shorts involve filmmaker Eva Snow and crime novelist and filmmaker Eric Pruitt, an occasional indie contributor, who decided to independently screen them in venues around the country instead of working the festival circuit. Snow co-stars in both and is the director of Cheat Proof, which was written by Pruitt from a story they conceived together, as was Keepsake, Snow's award-winning first film. It concerns a couple, Snow and Jim Muscatatter, meeting in a kind of kitschy, country-western-themed diner you'd see in a David Lynch or Jonathan Demme film, though actually, it's the former 501 building in Chapel Hill decorated by Snow to establish some ground rules for the adulterous fare they're trying not to have. The showy of the two shorts, it employs split screens, jumps cuts, black and white sequences, and more as the discussion turns into something very unsettling, confessions. It has a jazzy, unnerving rhythm that is sometimes compelling and sometimes distracting. Going Down Slow, written and directed by Pruitt, is a story of an unmarried couple, Snow and Michael Howard, dealing with a bad turn after a difficult decision. Structurally, the film constantly cross-cuts between flashbacks and flash-forwards in the tradition of such films as John Boorman's Point Blank. The fractured timeline is integral to the payoff, though it occasionally undercuts Pruitt's dark humor as the incident turns into a bizarre reckoning for the couple's relationship. But the short beautifully employs sun-soaked back roads in Riverside Forest. They would be the Haw River, and the accident that spurs the plot will feel like all too plausible to Durham drivers. There's a lot to like in both shorts, and one can only hope they beckon other Noirish filmmakers to follow down their dark Southern past. And now briefly from Back Talk, From the Rooftop. Last week, Leigh Taus wrote about how Raleigh City Council member Steph Mandel was the only speaker at a Board of Adjustment meeting who voiced concerns about the noise potentially associated with a rooftop dining area atop Scott Crawford's forthcoming Jolie Bistro. Normally, the story pointed out, council members are discouraged from attending meetings of the city boards and council commissions. But Mandel has a nearby condo that she rents out, so the rules didn't apply to her. Ultimately, the BOA allowed Crawford's dining area to go forward, albeit with some conditions, including that he build an 8-foot wall and not have any amplified music. I don't get people who want to live in a city but can't deal with city noises, writes Melanie Mayers. Those French bistros get pretty rowdy, adds Scott Dotson. And Elizabeth Winfield, Oakville is full of crotchety old biddies who have nothing better to do than to complain. Well, that's about it for another week. This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And a reminder, this program will be available as a podcast following its initial broadcast. So until next week, goodbye, good night, and good morning.